As part of our childbirth series, Beginnings, we're going to consider a parental dilemma that predates the big day. We're talking about the brain-racking, anxiety-producing, gotta-get-it-right task for parents-to-be that's settling on a name for a newborn. The popular TV comedy Friends captured the drama in that decision. On the show, Phoebe proposes that Ross and Rachel have the option to veto 5 baby names each. Rachel makes the first suggestion.
If it's a girl, Rain.
Veto.
Why?
Rain? Hi, my name is Rain. I have my own kiln, and my dress is made out of wheat.
Well, from there, things start to get a little out of hand.
How about Dayton?
Veto. Stewart.
Veto. Sawyer.
Veto. Helen.
Veto.
Is it me, or is Veto starting to sound really good?
Well, we called up Laura Wattenberg. She fancies herself a bit of a baby name wizard. In fact, that's the name of her website. She's got a popular blog, and she's written a book also called The Baby Name Wizard, a magical method for finding the perfect name for your baby. And she says it's hard for parents to find just the right name because the way children are named has changed.
For centuries, English speakers chose the same names generation after generation. You had your Johns and Marys and James and Elizabeth. And over the last 50 years, there has been a revolution. Naming is wide open today, and there is no normal. We're seeing a lot more creativity with invention, with spellings. And what that's created is a situation where most of us don't like each other's names. There's a lot more baby name hostility out there because our choices are so diverse.
Baby name hostility. Define that.
There's name rage in the streets. People write into us raging against what their neighbors name their babies. Everyone wants to be different. That's the number one thing we all have in common, is we don't want to be anything like one another. The problem is that our tastes are just as similar as they ever were. So what you're seeing is a lot of tiny variations on a theme, the Aiden, Braden, Caden generation. In fact, today, a third of all American boys get a name ending in the letter N.
And it seems like a lot of girls get a name ending in the letter A. Hannah, Sophia, Isabella, on and on and on.
A has always been the top letter for girls' names, but today there's a feeling that you can put almost anything before it. Just put an A at the end and you have an acceptable name.
What about popular culture, movies, or sport?
Parents will take names wherever they find them. So you'll even see a destructive hurricane, which you would think would be a terrible association for a baby name, actually encourages the use of that name. All it takes is that pregnant woman to say, Katrina, you know, that's actually kind of a pretty name.
Really?
If the name is attractive, if it's a Camille or an Isabel instead of a Floyd, the name will rise.
That's so interesting. You know, it sounds like there's sometimes mysteries. I remember reading a story about a cohort of young people who were all named Gage, and no one could figure out what that was about, and it turned out that it had something to do with a secondary character on a popular American television series.
Today, Gage is part of another mini-name phenomenon, which is movies about demonic children. If you have a movie with a really cute tot who's possessed by the devil, that is a recipe for a fashionable name. Gage, Regan, Adrian, these all were spawned by horror movies.
You're kidding. I thought like maybe like a movie like Damien that parents would run in the other direction, never want to name their kid that.
Damien is 100% the product of The Omen. Until then, almost no Americans chose that name.
Are there differences in terms of ethnic names? Is there sort of a blending or a cross-blending, or are there sort of separate and parallel universes?
Well, parents are more willing to use ethnic names. There was a time when immigrant parents automatically chose an English name for their children to give them an advantage. Today, we're actually seeing second and third generation immigrants are turning back to their grandparents' homeland and choosing names from other cultures for their children.
And what happened to all of the names that used to be popular? Where did all the Bettys, the Mildreds, the Shirleys go, or for boys, the Homers, the Seymours? Why is no one named Prudence anymore?
We see about a 100-year cycle. What you're looking at is your great-grandparents' generation. So our own names are too ordinary, our parents are too boring, our grandparents sound old. But when you get back to your great-grandparents, you actually never were surrounded by those names, so they sound fresh again.
Laura Wattenberg, good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's Laura Wattenberg. She's the author of The Baby Name Wizard. And you can see last year's most popular names and help one woman and her husband name their baby on NPR's Baby Project blog. That's at npr.org/baby. Baby Project.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. This month, while the broadcast networks are taking it easy, some cable competitors are serving up lots of excellent, unusual television. The action starts this weekend with a new version of the British sci-fi series Torchwood and the Larry David comedy Curb Your Enthusiasm. Torchwood is a show that may not even be on many people's radar. It's a British show which ran for 3 seasons and was imported and shown here by BBC America. It's a sci-fi series about a sort of overseas X-Files unit run by a cocky hero who is not only irreverent and American, but immortal, and a time traveler, and bisexual. It's a spin-off character and series from Doctor Who, the long-running British fantasy show that is still around, and has been around so long it launched the year John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It started as a kid's show, but in the hands of writer-producer Russell T. Davies, Doctor Who became more for adults, and Davies also is the man behind Torchwood. So if you're sneering at the idea of sci-fi and fantasy, you shouldn't, not if it's in the right hands. In the past, I've had to try to persuade people to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Lost, and Battlestar Galactica, and The Walking Dead, as genre shows that had something to say and said it cleverly. The same goes for Torchwood, which begins its new incarnation Friday on the Starz cable network. In this new version, John Barrowman remains in place as the star of Torchwood, and he soon meets up with one of his most feisty and dependable team members, Gwen Cooper, played by Eve Miles. But the rest of the Torchwood team died at the end of last season. So for this year, the survivors come out of hiding and move to America, the center of a new global threat that sounds harmless but is just the opposite. All of a sudden, all across the planet, people stop dying. Starting with death row prisoner Oswald Daines, played by Bill Pullman, who survives his own execution. In a montage of channel surfing that's disturbingly credible, the media instantly come up with a catchy name for this inexplicable new phenomenon.
The survival of Oswald Daines turns out to be the first incident in a much bigger story breaking live this morning.
When the Kentucky Medical Authority made a chance comment that it hadn't recorded a single death over 24 hours,
17 more authorities immediately reported the same thing. The story exploded on social network sites.
Cuando la palabra
miracle trending as the number one top bane to California, the story's the same.
For the past 36 hours,
no fatalities have been reported.
No one has
Not
died.
Not one person in the United States
Not
of America.
Not a single death.
Miracle Day.
Miracle Day. That's what it's being called.
Miracle Day. As usual, the media are missing the real story. When no one dies, what does that do to population growth? To the spread of infectious but now non-lethal diseases? To war and terrorism and thrill-seeking and so many other things? Torchwood, the task force, and the TV series takes all of this very, very seriously, and doesn't presume it's some sort of natural phenomenon. So if someone engineered this so-called miracle, the big questions soon become who and why. The acting, as well as the writing, is really strong here. Barrowman, as Jack Harkness, is an old-school swashbuckler with new-school sass, kind of like a bisexual Bruce Willis. Bill Pullman, who usually plays the likable hero in films like Independence Day, portrays a creepy, odious pedophile murderer here, yet one who, thanks to the media, finds both a voice and a mission. And Lauren Ambrose, who was so wonderful in 6 Feet Under as teenager Claire Fisher, gets a meaty adult role here as an opportunistic agent who offers to represent the executed but not dead killer. I've previewed the first 3 episodes of Torchwood, and they left me hanging and eager to see more. So give it a chance, please. And if you want to catch up, BBC Home Video is releasing the entire 3-season British version of Torchwood on DVD and Blu-ray July 19th. And now for something completely different. On Sunday, HBO presents the 8th-season premiere of Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, one of the funniest and daringly different shows ever made for television. It's been a long time since we've seen the exaggerated TV version of Larry David in action. The last time was in November 2009, when he taped the Seinfeld reunion show and lost his chance to reconnect successfully with his estranged wife Cheryl, played by Cheryl Hines. The new season begins with an episode called The Divorce, echoing the comedian's real-life divorce from his wife, Lori, 4 years ago. But I haven't seen that episode. HBO and Larry David are holding their cards close to the vest and instead have sent out 3 random, non-sequential episodes from the new season. The story arc this season takes Larry to New York, and one of the 3 episodes I've seen explains why, but I won't spoil it. It's enough to say that if you missed Larry David as the self-appointed policeman of all things that irritate him, one of the new episodes calls him a social assassin, get ready for a lot more moments of outrage, and a few that may make you uncomfortable. When his friend Marty Funkhauser, played by Bob Einstein, reaffirms his Jewish faith and leads Larry and his friends in prayer at dinner, Larry, who's also Jewish, quickly reaches his limit of religious tolerance. Others at the table include Susie Essman, Jeff Garlin, and Larry Miller.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem min haaretz.
Amen.
Amen.
Now the wine?
What?
Okay.
Baruch no way, no way. Adonai. That's enough. Elohim. Come on. No, I'm hungry.
Well, you can't drink the wine without the prayer.
Oh, you can't? Really? Watch this.
I'm with Larry on this.
Guess we're drinking.
To the 5-man club championship.
Here.
Now you're thinking. Cheers.
Everybody, eat up. Come on.
Oh, did you guys hear about this? You know the what's the chicken place in Westwood, the Palestinian one?
Oh. What is it called?
Al Abbas. Best original chicken. They're opening up a second location right next door to Goldblatt's Deli.
Over my dead body.
I'm sure that wouldn't bother them.
Even if you agree with Larry David's TV alter ego on principle, he always ends up going too far. For me, his Curb Your Enthusiasm character ranks up there with John Cleese's Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers. They're both guys whose ability to embarrass themselves, while persisting in venting their outrage against the world, ranks them among television's most original and entertaining comedy characters. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today we wrap up our series on the changing notion of what it means to be all American. For decades, it's been shorthand for a certain idea, often captured in advertising. Things like rugged strength or wholesomeness. Think the Marlboro Man or maybe a Brett girl brushing her long hair.
It's like getting a brush in a bottle when you use Breck shampoo.
57.
Breck brings out the shine in your hair, like brushing 100 strokes.
America looks very different today, and so too do the ads. The disposable income controlled by minorities is growing at a much faster rate than for white households. Hispanics alone control $1 trillion in purchasing power. To get a sense of how changing demographics have reshaped advertising, we turn to Roberto Orsi, president of the Acento Ad Agency, and Jimmy Smith, creative director of TBWA Shiat Day. He says there's been a clear shift in his business.
I think you see advertising that's ahead of what's really going on in America. The advertisers are definitely, they understand that more than just white America is buying their products. So they're trying to reach all cultures and all races, whether it's Latino, Black, Asian, or, you know, Native American. It doesn't matter. They just see that as another opportunity to sell their product.
Roberto, is that true for you as well?
Yes. One of the things, another thing that's changed, I agree with everything Jimmy said, is that in the past, people would talk about multicultural as to do a social good, like it was the right thing to do and it was good for PR. That's not the case anymore. And the push for multicultural marketing is coming from the very top. It makes sense for business now, and it's well recognized.
There's an ad that is in such heavy rotation that I'm betting that most of our listeners have probably seen or heard it. I'm talking about the ad for Dos Equis beer and the most interesting man in the world at the center of that ad. This man is shown in this advertisement in all these James Bond-like scenes.
He lives vicariously through himself. He is the most interesting man in the world.
I don't always drink beer. But when I do, I prefer Dos Equis.
This man is beyond hip. Now, not long ago, how unlikely would it be that the most interesting man in the world was Latino?
That is a big change in the market. And it's been evolving over time because in the same category, beer, we had the Corona beer, which became very popular with their beach ads. Those were all Mexican beaches, and it was trying to help you imagine what vacation was in Cancun and try to recapture that spirit. Now they've become much more overt with the most interesting man in the world, and it's really interesting because it does put that market at the same level. It's a good sign.
Jimmy?
That beer campaign is, in my opinion, is one of the greatest of all times. It's a classic. And, you know, as we creatives say, when we see something like that, we always go, I wish I had done that. But it's not a Latino guy. I'm sure there was a Latino cat that would have killed that role.
The interesting thing about that comment is that myself as a Latino, I would not have known that he wasn't Latino. I mean, I would have to have inside information because it's such a blended race that you have all kinds of colors and hair and eyes, but he looks Latino and he sounds Latino. My God, he looks like my Uncle Raul, actually. He does. Well, my vote for the most interesting man in the world is the campaign of the Smell Like a Man. And he's African-American, but I think he represents what all of us would like to be. And I think that's a fantastic campaign that takes a multicultural character and makes them apply to the whole country.
You're talking about the man that sells Old Spice, the fellow who looks like he spends a whole lot of time in the gym.
Yes.
Hello, ladies. Look at your man. Now back to me. Now back at your man. Now back to me. Sadly, he isn't me. But if he stopped using lady-scented body wash and switched to Old Spice, he could smell like he's me. Look down. Back up. Where are you? You're on a boat with the man your man could smell like.
Now, are they selling Old Spice there, or are they selling a really handsome man?
I think they're doing both.
You've both been in the business for quite a while, decades, in fact, and I want you to take me back to early discussions and help me understand how these discussions have changed, discussions with your clients about their expectations and the audience that they want to reach. You know, what did that discussion used to sound like, and how has it changed? What does it sound like now?
Early on, in the 80s and 90s, it was trying to convince marketers that there was a Hispanic market because everybody believed back then that Hispanics would all assimilate as other immigrants have done. In other words, in 10 years, they'll all be speaking English. There'll be no need for Hispanic marketing. That has been thoroughly debunked because of the fact that the language is still very strong and the culture is very strong. So now the conversations with marketers is, how big is the opportunity? What is the sweet spot? Where can I get the most bang for my buck?
Jimmy?
For me, it was my first gig was at Burrell Advertising, which is an African-American advertising agency and one of the first. And every time I would present something to the client, they would come back, well, what's black about that? And one of the times I presented a black cowboy in an ad, right? And the client didn't understand that there were actually black cowboys. They were like, well, why do you have a black cowboy? That's not going to target the African-Americans. There's no such thing as black cowboys. So you don't get those questions anymore.
What are those conversations like today?
I can't tell you when the last time is I had a conversation about race. I present ads that they can be targeting people that play golf, and I might have, you know, all Latinos in it or something like that. The question never, ever comes up. Like, again, I've worked on a lot of sports brands. People understand now that when you're targeting youth, sports is just sports is sports is sports, and it's colorblind.
So it's not that you're having overt conversations about race. It's just that multiculturalism is expected.
It's expected. They want it to be multicultural.
Jimmy Smith, Roberta Orsi, good to talk to both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Roberta Orsi is the president of the Acento Ad Agency, and Jimmy Smith is creative director at TBWA Chiat Day in Los Angeles.
This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Comedians don't like to talk about comedy any more than magicians like to talk about their tricks. Comedy isn't chemistry. You can't put laughs together like some kind of recipe. Sometimes you can do everything that seems right and fall flat, or do everything wrong, but still win a laugh. Paul Provenza, the comedian and producer, is returning for a second season this summer with his Showtime series, The Green Room. Comedians just sit around and talk there about what they do, their careers, their lives, unscripted, uncensored. Ray Romano, Kathy Griffin, Margaret Cho, Louis Black, Franklin Ajay, Bo Burnham, Gary Shandling, and dozens of others. Paul Provenza is also co-producer of the film The Aristocrats. That's about the greatest joke you can't tell, and the book Satiristas. Paul Provenza joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Is it hard to get comedians to talk as opposed to perform?
Well, it's hard to get them to do that in front of TV cameras. We really strive for an authentic feeling of what it's like when comedians are hanging out amongst themselves. To get comedians to really open up and be free of the need to get a laugh every so-and-so seconds mm-hmm. and that kind of thing is a lot like trying to get pandas to mate in captivity. You know, everything has to be just.
Now I know what you mean. Yeah.
Everything has to be just right. You know, if the temperature's off by a degree or two, nothing's happening.
Let's play certainly one of my favorite exchanges. It's between the young comic Bo Burnham, who I believe is all of 20 years old.
An absolute phenom.
And Ray Romano and Gary Shandling.
I'm of the younger generation, so I just wonder for all of you, who are you?
All right, now you can talk.
It's so good. It's so good because it's so mutual.
Now, Bo Burnham, he might deserve a special kind of signature in comic history. Did he pay his dues on the web as opposed to clubs?
Bo is a very interesting cat. I actually first became aware of Bo when Super Deluxe was a website creating original comedy programming, and they were very interested in doing something with me, and I didn't have anything in particular that I wanted to do. And so I would be rooting around on the internet, and I found this kid. And I called him out of nowhere. And first of all, he happened to know who I was, so I thought, wow, he must really be hip to comedy. Because
he's a student of humor.
Yeah, I'm not exactly a household name. And he was like, this isn't really Paul Provenza. And I said, yes, it is. When I finally convinced him, he said, well, listen, can I call you back because I'm on a field trip with my class? And I said, how old are you? And he said, 15. And I was like, oh, my goodness. He's just remarkable. Brilliant, brilliant kid.
I was touched when Ray Romano tells you that he's very happy. And why shouldn't he be? He's hugely successful and quite wealthy. But he says his happiest days were earlier in his career.
Yeah.
Why?
I think it's because in the early days, you don't really, there's so much more passion, and it's passion that's sort of untainted by business. There is something about, you know, spending your night just hanging out with other young comics who also have aspirations and also are as ignorant to what's to come as you are. And it's just, wow, I'm doing stand-up comedy, you know, thing I've dreamed of doing, and I'm doing it well if you're lucky enough to be in that position. There's a certain purity and innocence to it all.
Number of the comics talk about getting older, the difficulty of putting yourself across as a comedian, in a sense, as your material becomes better known, as your personality becomes well known. Here's a clip, Ray Romano, and he talks about his admiration for Bill Cosby.
The fear is, as you get older, you don't hold up anymore. Right. And it was great, you know, he's 73 years old, and I was laughing just like I was when he was young, yeah.
Did you picture your career this way when you start out? Is it like what you wanted?
Not here.
And also, the more successful they come, do comics have a hard time keeping current? Keeping their instrument
It is,
sharp.
You know, it's a very, very big, big challenge, which is one of the reasons why the late, great George Carlin is such an inspiration, because at the age of 72, he'd be performing to an audience with 15-year-olds in it and 50-year-olds in it, and they're both laughing at the exact same things at the exact same time. You cannot find another 72-year-old comedian who is as attractive to 15-year-olds as he is to 50-year-olds, and he doesn't do a thing differently for either of them.
I really admired the exchange about Stephen Hawking.
Is he married, by the way?
Yeah. And cheated on his wife. That's the best part.
With what? That's the definition of man. A guy who can't move nor talk still managed to cheat on his wife. You know, that is the definition of the male gene. It's like you have seconds to live. What's your name?
You folks make you have some good humor, let's put it that way, about Stephen Hawking without mocking his disabilities.
Thank you. That I'm very delighted that you recognize that, because that's a big misconception about comedians. Now, granted, there are a lot of comedians who are insensitive. Having said that, there is a vast population of very artful, thoughtful comedians, and that's not what artists care about.
Do women comics have a harder time being taken as funny?
I'll tell you, among the funniest comedians I've ever known are women like Sarah Silverman, Kathleen Madigan, Paula Poundstone, Wendy Liebman, Elaine Boozler. I mean, there's a lot of really, really, really funny women out there. And the only reason that that's not obvious is because somehow this idea that women aren't funny got implanted in people's minds, and then they're suspicious of actually funny women.
Paul, what's your current thinking? Do people say or do something funny, or are some people just funny?
Both are correct. There are people like Eddie Pepitone. Eddie Pepitone is an unsung genius. He can't walk into a room and not be funny. And then there are other people who really, really are brilliantly funny through what they craft and create. The very unhidden secret of the show, the whole premise of it really is music. And what I do there is not so much have a talk show, it's just here's an artist who works a particular way, here's an artist who works a different particular way. It's just like, well, what happens if we put them all together in the same band and ask them to jam?
Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Paul Provenza, host and co-producer of The Green Room, which returns to Showtime next Thursday, July 14, and runs through the summer.